My name is Paul Olson. I'm a teacher at Augustana College when I'm not up here. And I teach English. And a couple of the courses I teach are in African American literature. And I always feel when I'm doing some gig outside of our college, I should explain how a Norwegian white guy from Minnesota got hooked up teaching black literature. And the reason of all, we had a black lit, we had Toni Morrison a couple days ago, but this book changed my life. I had a master's degree in English, history and English, undergraduate history and English double major, English major from good school, a couple summers at the University of Minnesota, had finished, except for two courses, a master's degree at the University of Oregon, and I was sitting in a class and a teacher referred to Richard Wright. And I turned to my friend, who was black, and my best friend in undergraduate, because we played basketball together every day, and he was doing the same coursework that I was. I said to him, "Who's Richard Wright?" I had never heard of him. And I'm illustrating that with, that's institutional racism. No one sat there and said, "Don't read the black folks." But it just kind of evolved somehow that these are the people we read, and we just kind of put them back on the shelf. And I doubt that that was ever a conscious move. Of course you read Shakespeare, of course you read Wordsworth, of course you read Faulkner. I mean, but this didn't happen. And my black friend would never have heard of him either, except for his parents. Because he went through a different college, same graduate school, but through this, generally speaking, the same kind of curriculum that I had gone through, and had it not been for his parents, he wouldn't have known Richard Wright either, he said. So that said, I thought to myself, and it started out simply as a matter of justice, really. This isn't right that personally I should be deprived of this, or that our students should not know who this is, and that we should perpetuate this kind of what I've called institutional racism. This was the first book I ever read by a black author. And I can remember exactly where I was, I can remember the time of day, I can remember the weather. I was alone, I was on a beach at Oregon, just outside of Eugene, Oregon, and I read the first story, Big Boy Leaves Home, and I put it down and wiped a tear out of my eye and changed my life in terms of my academic, well, personal life too, but my academic life, where it went from then on. I share that with you just to give some kind of sense of what's a white Minnesotan from the Norwegian heritage doing with all this black literature stuff. That said, I'd like to look at three stories in this collection of short stories. You want to get these dates down for the quiz. So, but in 1938, Richard Wright published Uncle Tom's Children. That's what I'm going to read from. It's an essay, five short stories, and it's more complicated than this one year because he added a story and so on, but that's good enough. In 1940, the book that most people who have read Wright have read, it was Native Son. In 1945, he's written more than this, but these are the big popular ones for him. Black Boy, that's his autobiography. About whom a U.S. senator said, this is the filthiest, dirtiest, lousiest book you'll ever read, but it was written by a Negro, and what can you expect? On the Senate floor of our Congress. It's in the congressional record.
Which year?
The year it came out, 1945. Wow. But if you know the history at all of anybody, it's Theodore Villeneuve, when he was a noted racist. And, what can you expect from him, like you said about it? But I set this up just to make this point. Eleanor Roosevelt read Uncle Tom's Children and wrote Richard Wright a letter in which she said, "I wept after every single story." And I identify with that because I did too. And he then didn't respond. I don't know if he responded to that letter or not. There's no record of that. But he did respond in public about that, and said, in 1938, "The next book I write," I'm quoting him, "will be so hard and so deep, no one will have the consolation of tears." And what he meant was, I want more than just your empathy and your pity. I want action. So, already in 1938, he's a communist, and what all that points out, and that's a complicated thing as well, And he joins the Communist Party, leaves the Communist Party because they too were telling him what to do and what to read and what he couldn't read. And he said, baloney. That's not a quote. But he, the sense, I think, of joining the Communist Party is we need radical change in the economic and social structure of our country before black people will ever be treated with any kind of respect and equality. So all that said, that's a little bit of history of this book and his purposes in this book. I'm sure he had one idea about art. Art is to create such a powerful emotional stimuli that you can't not act. So I'll read a couple passages and we'll set you up on these stories. And I also want to suggest that there are some themes. There are lots of themes in this complicated book and in all of his complicated writing. One of those, not surprisingly, is freedom. I'm going to put them down so we can just watch for them as we go. Another one is a destruction of absolutes or destroying myths and prejudice and assumptions that are just kind of crazy. Another one is that we'll see is that the natural world kind of versus the social world. And that's not a simple thing either, you know. If we were just animals, we live in the natural world and we're bears and we, you know, innocent fawns, like we heard about this morning. It doesn't mean that. It means there's this world of being natural, of wanting, you'll see it, of when I'm hot, I want to go swimming in a swimming hole. In fact, I'll set you up with that. In this natural world, we've got some little kids who are hot and sweaty. And what do you do when you're hot and sweaty? You cool off, and there is, versus the social world, is a great big sign right by this pool that says no trespassing. And that's this symbol of the social world interrupting in the natural world. Okay, enough said. I'll just read. I've always been the kind of teacher that tries not to let myself get in the way of the literature. This is what you came to hear, not me. Well, the big boy leaves home. The setup of the story is there are Buck, Bobo, Lester, and Big Boy. They're all about 11 years old, or 12 or so. And they skip school this day. And it's clear through the first, 26 pages that these guys are kids. They play the dozens of typical African-American game of your mother wears combat boots, that's nothing. Your mother wears combat boots and she smokes, that's nothing. Your mother wears combat boots and she smokes and she drinks whiskey. And they just keep kind of top each other. So they're playing this game, they wrestle, and it establishes that these kids are innocent. They don't really know what's going on in the world. Skipping school is no big deal. But they do know some things. A train goes by and they hear its whistle, and one of them says, that's from up north. Yeah, I hear black folks got equal rights up there. So they know something about that. They also know, because they know that this no trespassing sign, as they say, means no niggers and no dogs. So they are innocent at the age of 11, but that innocence is tainted with a kind of experience that maybe an 11-year-old white kid wouldn't have. All that said, they have skipped school. They're ready to jump in the pool, in this pond, I should say, of farmer Jim, and this I have to get right into this light, so excuse me for hiding from you. There goes number 7, heading for up north. That's the train. Blazing it down the line. Lord, I'm going up north someday. Me too, man. They say colored folks up north has got equal rights. They grew pensive. Now here's this natural world, just illustrated for us with great description. They grew pensive. A black-winged butterfly hovered at the water's edge, a bee drone. From somewhere came the sweet scent of honeysuckles. Dimly, they could hear sparrows twittering in the woods. They rolled from side to side, they'd been wrestling. Letting sunshine dry their skin and warm their blood, they plucked blades of grass and chewed them. Oh. It's Wordsworth, who's in the 19th century poet, says, he's talking about another poet, he says, but in the power of one word, he was praising Keats. He said, in the power of one word, he can change the motion and the emotion of the whole poem. So we've had this beautiful setting of a bee droning in the sunshine and the sparrows, and they pluck blades of grass and they chew them. And oh, they know what's happened because a white woman has come down to the pond. And now all kinds of assumptions are going to be made, but they know about those. Anybody know what happened to a kid named Emmett Till in 1954?
Yeah.
What was it?
He whistled. He went down south to visit his aunt and whistled at a white girl or flirted with her or winked at her or something, and they killed him.
Ended up in the Mississippi River.
Ended up in the Mississippi River. And the two guys that were accused of it were off scot-free, and then later they confessed and told their story to the newspaper. But they got away with it. So these kids, remember, they're innocent, but they've seen a white woman. They know that, okay. Oh, they looked up, their lips parting. Oh, a white woman poised on the edge of the opposite embankment stood directly in front of them, her hat in her hand and her hair lit by the sun. It's a woman, big boy said under his breath. A white woman. They stared. Their hands skipped instinctively, covering their groins. Then they scrambled to their feet. The white woman backed slowly out of sight. They stood for a moment, looking at one another. Let's get out of here, big boy whispered. Wait till she goes away. No, let's run. They'll catch us here naked like this. Maybe there's a man with her. Come on, let's get our clothes, said big boy. They waited a moment, longer, listening. What the hell? I'm going to get my clothes, said big boy. Grabbing a short tuft of grass, he climbed the embankment. Don't run out there now. Come on back here, you fool. Bobo hesitated. He looked at big boy and then at Buck and Lester. I'm going with big boy to get my clothes, he said. Don't run out there naked like that, you fool, said Buck. You don't know who's out there. Big boy was climbing over the edge of the embankment. Come on, he whispered. Bobo climbed after. 25 feet away, the woman stood. She had one hand over her mouth. Hanging by fingers, Buck and Lester peeped over the edge. Come on back. That woman's scared, said Lester. Big boy stopped, puzzled. He looked at the woman. He looked at the bundle of clothes. Then he looked at Buck and Lester. Come on, let's get our clothes. He made a step. Jim! The woman screamed. Big boy stopped and looked around. His hands hung loosely at his sides. The woman, her eyes wide, her hand over her mouth, backed away to the tree where their clothes lay in a heap. Big boy, come back and wait till she's gone. Bobo ran to Big Boy's side. Let's go home. They'll catch us here. Let's get out. Big Boy's throat felt tight. Lady, we just want to get our clothes. Buck and Lester climbed the embankment and stood indecisively. Big Boy ran toward the tree. Jim! The woman screamed. Jim! Jim! Black and naked. Big Boy stopped 3 feet from her. We just want to get our clothes. He made a motion. You go away! You go away, I tell you! You go away! Big boy stopped again, afraid. Bobo ran and snatched the clothes. Buck and Lester tried to grab them out of his hands. You go away, you go away, you go away. Let's go, said Bobo, running toward the woods. The word is spelled C-R-A-C-K. Crack! And it's the sound of a rifle. Lester grunted, stiffened, and pitched forward. His forehead struck a toe of the woman's shoes. Bobo stopped, clutching the clothes. Buck whirled. Big boy stared at Lester, his lips moving. He's got a gun. He's got a gun, yelled Buck, running wildly. Crack! Buck stopped at the edge of the embankment, his head jerked backward, his body arched stiffly to one side, and he toppled headlong, sending up a shower of blood straight into the sunlight. The creek bubbled. Big Boy and Bobo backed away, their eyes fastened fearfully on a white man who was running toward them. He had a rifle and wore an army officer's uniform. He ran to the woman's side and grabbed her hand. You hurt, Bertha, you hurt! She stared at him and did not answer. The man turned quickly. His face was red. He raised the rifle and pointed it at Bobo. Bobo ran back, holding the clothes in front of his chest. Don't shoot me, mister. Don't shoot me. I'll continue. But any reactions so far?
Yeah.
What's the first thing the guy does? The first thing?
Shoots.
Shoots. How can he do that? It's not, are you hurt, Bertha? You must be. Bang. It's bang. Except, oh, real question. He can do this. He has all the rights in the world to do this. And watch him, other assumptions he's going to make as he goes through this whole process. And what about Bertha? Assumptions.
But she's being attacked.
Huh?
But she's being attacked first.
She's being attacked. How old are these kids?
11.
11. How tall is an 11-year-old? I don't know. I was 3'1". I don't know. But they're little kids. And Jim, you go away. Can they explain their way out of it? Hey, we just want to get our clothes. That's all. You'll ask later, can he explain his way out of this? Well, we'll see more. So he has said, don't shoot me. Big boy lunged for the rifle, grabbing the barrel. You black son of a bitch. Big boy clung desperately. Let go, you black bastard. The barrel pointed skyward. Crack! The white man, taller and heavier, flung Big Boy to the ground. Bobo dropped the clothes, ran up, and jumped on the white man's back. You black sons of bitches! The white man released the rifle, jerked Bobo to the ground, and began to batter the naked boy with his fists. And then Big Boy swung, striking the man in the head with the mouth of the barrel. His teeth caved in, and he fell dazed. Bobo was on his feet. Come on, Big Boy, let's go! Breathing hard, the white man got up and faced Big Boy. His lips were trembling, his neck and chin were wet with blood. He spoke quietly. Give me that gun, boy. What do you make of that?
Kill him.
He'll kill Big Boy when he gets the gun. I wrote in my margin, it's still there. I've transferred it from about 6 volumes of this, though. To think that he would. I've just killed 2 of your friends, beat the tar out of the other one, and I can just say to you, give me that gun, boy. We're talking about assumptions and the destructions of assumptions. And these little kids have to deal with this and watch them as it continues. Big boy leveled the rifle and backed away. The white man advanced. Boy, I say, give me that gun. Bobo had the clothes in his arms. Run, big boy, run. The man came at big boy. I'll kill you, said big boy. His fingers fumbled for the trigger. The man stopped, blinked, spat blood. His eyes were bewildered. His face whitened. Suddenly he lunged for the rifle, his hands outstretched. Crack! Fell forward on his face. Jim! Big Boy and Bobo turned in surprise to look at the woman. Jim! She screamed again and fell weakly at the foot of the tree. Big Boy dropped the rifle, his eyes wide. He looked around. Bobo was crying and clutching the clothes. Big Boy! Big Boy! Big Boy looked at the rifle, started to pick it up, but didn't. He seemed at a loss. He looked at Lester, then at the white man. His eyes followed a thin stream of blood that seeped to the ground. You done killed him, murmured Bobo. Let's go home. And there's more. Any thoughts about the whole scene?
The white man just simply feels that those are animals, that he really has no concern whatsoever,
yeah.
And they have to respond to his commands.
Yeah, very good. Animals, he can do whatever he wants, shoot before he asks. They're little kids. And when he does give an order, he expects him to obey it. And look what it gets him. I read a literary critic a long time ago who said he was trying to make this an Aristotelian tragedy. That Big Boy, it's his fault because he didn't make the right decisions. What do you think about that?
There weren't any right decisions.
There are no right decisions, yeah. What do you mean by that? You're absolutely right.
Well, it seems like there were just two tracks on their way. Logic of the social situation of those days just played itself out.
Yeah.
A white guy with a gun and a woman and
yeah.
Kids.
Yeah, good.
Just a collision.
All these things. White woman,
yeah.
Black boy, gun, and then all these assumptions that go with it. Assumptions about myself as a white man with my power. Assumptions about black men and only boys and white women. If Emmett Till gets killed for saying bye, baby, to a white woman, this kid from Chicago who didn't know any better, who had pictures of white friends, he didn't get it, but you don't do that in the South.
The young black boy's response is strictly animal behavior. They're responding in an animal behavior process where they don't know any difference but to try and survive or escape.
Yeah, and then escape, but that's good. And then, but where do they say they're going?
Home.
Let's go home. And then they're going to go home and get a lawyer and plead self-defense?
Yeah.
Right. 1938? I don't think so.
But the boys did try and reason, I mean, beyond the animal behavior. I mean, they did try and say, we just want our clothes.
Yeah. I think the animal behavior talking about is just the fear that's so great that now we just got to survive. But they used reason. They used common sense, really. We just want our clothes. But it's not going
to
fly.
Not that it mattered. I mean, they were up to no good.
No, right. They're up to
the white man
things that happens in really in lots of literature, but especially African American literature, especially Richard Rice literature, is that characters have kind of a hard spot in a rock to choose from. They can live physically, but if they do, they will die spiritually. We'll watch that. Mm-hmm. Or they can live spiritually, be their own man, their own woman, their own person. And if they do, well, they're going to get killed. Can you marry a white woman? Can you live my own way, love the people I want to? No. Well, this gets even a little more complicated. Big Boy goes home, and I'll skip this part, but, I won't either. I can summarize it and then just read the end of it. He comes home, and his dad isn't home yet. He's in another room, and he starts telling his mother that he's really in trouble. And he says, he killed Buck, he killed Lester, and I killed him. He tells his mother that. And she says to her daughter, Big Boy's sister, go get Saul. Saul is her husband, Big Boy's father. Now remember, he has told his mother that the two of his friends are killed and he killed a white man. And I'll just read just a couple paragraphs here. Father walks in, here it is. What's Big Boy into now? He asked sternly. Saul. Big Boy's done gotten into trouble with the white folks. Saul. It's a white woman.
Oh.
That's the crime. She knows it. That's in Native Son, those of you who have read it. The crime isn't murder. The crime is that he raped her before he murdered her. He didn't. But that's what everybody's going to expect. And her first response is, you can get in trouble. But what's the biggest trouble of all? Messing with a white woman. This whole purity of the white Southern virgin. And it's an ironic thing historically because it was the white men who raped the black slaves. The characters talk again and again. Mother says four different times in the story, and if you see something four times in the story, you know it's important, right? Big Boy, I don't know what we can do. Only God can help you now. And again, that's their only hope. Justice is not going to help. It's going to take some kind of crazy miracle. Of course, it won't help. And only God can help you now. We just got to ship you out of here. They put them on a truck and send them up north. And then the white people come in and burn down their house. But Big Boy runs first because he's got to hide out for a night before this truck's going to pick him up. It's his uncle going to take him up to the north. And here are his choices. Here's something for you to eat. Take off, Big Boy, because that's all anybody can do now. Just pray. He's got to hide somewhere at night, and he comes to this hill where he and his buddies have been digging holes in there. They call them kilns. And imagine yourself doing this. He stopped at the foot of the hill, trying to choose between two patches of black kilns high above him. He went to the left, for there lay the ones he, Bobo, Lester, and Buck had dug only last week. He looked around again. The landscape was bare. He climbed the embankment and stood before a row of black pits sinking 4 and 5 feet deep into the earth. He went to the largest and peered in. He's 11. You're out in the woods, and there's this hole. You're going to climb into it. He stiffened when his ears caught the sound of a whirr. It's a snake. He ran back a few steps and poised on his toes. 6 feet of snake slid out of the pit and went into coil. Big Boy looked around wildly for a stick. He ran down the slope, peering into the grass. He stumbled over a tree limb. He picked it up and tested it by striking it against the ground. Warily, he crept back to the slope, his stick poised. When about 7 feet from the snake, he stopped and waved the stick. The coil grew tighter. The whir sounded louder, and a flat head reared to strike. He went to the right, and the flat head followed him, the blue-black tongue darting forth. He went to the left, and the flat head followed him there, too. He stopped, teeth clenched. He had to kill this snake. Just had to kill him. This was the safest pit on the hillside. He waved the stick again, looking at the snake before, thinking of a mob behind. I'll stop here and read a poem. by Richard Wright. This is for sure Wright's most popular poem, and the images of what Big Boy is afraid of is why he'll take on this snake. And one morning while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing, stumbled upon it in a grassy clearing guarded by scaly oaks and elms, and the sooty details of the scene rose, thrusting themselves between the world and me. There was a design of white bones slumbering forgottenly upon a cushion of ashes. There was a charred stump of a sapling pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky. There were torn tree limbs, tiny veins of burnt leaves, and a scorched coil of greasy hemp. I'll continue. It's a lynching. There were 12 men lynched in 1948 in the state of Kansas. In 2003, there were three crosses burned on the front lawn of a black family in Dubuque, Iowa. They know what's coming, and it's not just 1938. A vacant shoe, an empty tie, a ripped shirt, a lonely hat, and a pair of trousers stiff with black blood. And upon the trampled grass were buttons, dead matches, butt ends of cigars and cigarettes, peanut shells, a drained gin flask, and a whore's lipstick. Scattered traces of tar, restless arrays of feathers, and the lingering smell of gasoline. And through the morning air, the sun poured yellow surprise into the eye sockets of a stony skull. And while I stood there, my mind was frozen with a cold pity that was gone. The ground gripped my feet, and my heart was circled by icy walls of fear. The sun died in the sky, a night wind muttered in the grass and fumbled the leaves and the trees. The woods poured forth the hungry yelping of hounds. The darkness screamed with thirsty voices, and the witnesses rose and lived. The dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones. The gray ashes formed flesh, firm and black, entering into my flesh. The gin flask passed from mouth to mouth. Cigars and cigarettes glowed. The whore smeared lipstick red upon her lips. And 1,000 faces swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. And then they had me, stripped me, battering my teeth into my throat till I swallowed my own blood. My voice was drowned in the roar of their voices, and my black, wet body slipped and rolled in their hands as they bound me to the sapling. And my skin clung to the bubbling hot tar, falling from me in limp patches. And the down and quills of the white feather sank into my raw flesh, and I moaned in my agony. Then my blood was cooled mercifully, cooled by a baptism of gasoline, and in a blaze of red I leaped to the sky as pain rose like water boiling my limbs. Panting, begging, I clutched childlike, clutched to the hot sides of death. And then the poet says, now I am dry bones, and my voice a stony skull staring in yellow surprise at the sun. The images are clear. What is this lynching? Peanut shells, gin flask.
It's
entertainment. Well, they cry out for souvenirs. And Bobo, Big Boy, and I'll skip to another story, kills the snake. And then he wants to crawl inside to make sure there aren't any more, but he has to go inside to do it. He's 11. But he knows that this is his other option. The mob behind or the snake in the kiln. Well, he goes into the snake, and later on they come up after him with dogs, and a dog comes to his hole and finds him and starts barking. He pulls the dog in and kills it. And he lives through the night and gets on the truck, and he's off, and that's the end of the story. Any thoughts about any of that? It's a wonderful book. This book is in I don't know if it is or not. The Color Purple. I was going to advertise that for you. That is in the bookstore. Yeah, Pete.
I'm going back to the first decision. Stay in the weeds or go for your clothes. One's passive and one's active. You know, we we'll stay invisible, maybe we'll be all right. Mm-hmm. Versus I'm going to try to survive, take some action, and leave. And that gets repeated and repeated, whether it's pulling a dog in, killing a snake.
Yeah, yeah.
And if there was a decision that got him in trouble or to the north, it was started way back then, I think.
It did, and maybe even here. The sign says no trespassing. We're going to go anyway.
Well, it's interesting that there was no option of just leaving the clothes and run. That didn't cross their mind, apparently.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to leave my clothes.
Yeah. Well, it's
probably the only clothes you got.
Well, that's right.
Probably trace them back to them anyway if they found their clothes.
Well, just the fact that we use the word decision says something about our rationale coming to this whole episode, and the rationale and the thinking process of an 11-year-old, who's filled with all these images. Up north, they got equal rights. No trespassing means no niggers. No, they know, and yet, so what responds this decision? I mean, what precipitates this decision? Fear.
Survival.
Survival. Yeah. Well, the next. I'm skipping the story. The next one is called. Long Black Song, and this story is of a black man married with a baby, and he's making it economically. He owns or is buying off his farm, and he's gone to town to sell his crops, and he's also going to pick up a piece of cloth for his wife, and when he comes back, he eventually tells her, I got good money for the crops, I'm going to get me a hired man. Isn't that what the white folks do? And this is part of the natural world and the social world, and illustrated in a different way. I'm going to do what the culture says. I'm going to make it. And we'll see what happens to him as he tries to make it, if I can read this in the light. But before all that happens, he's in town, and his wife is in the... at home, and they have a baby. I mentioned that, and I asked this question at 127. I do ask this question to you guys: can idealism live in a world like we see Emmett Till killed, and we see Big Boy have to run away from home? And his wife is thinking, she saw green fields wrapped in the thickening gloam. It was as if they had left the earth, these fields, and were floating slowly skyward. The afterglow lingered, red, dying, somehow tenderly sad, and far away in front of her, earth and sky met in a soft swoon of shadow. A cricket chirped, sharp and lonely. And it seemed that she could hear a chirping long after it had stopped. Silas ought to be coming soon. I'm tired of staying here by myself. This is this natural world, they're farmers that they live in. And along comes a white salesman who has a gramophone that he's going to sell her. And he's a young guy, he goes to the University of Chicago, so he's a college age kid, and she's a young woman. And though, read the story if you're curious, though it's ambiguously described, he either seduces, my opinion is clear, or rapes her. And he says things like, come on, Auntie, I'm not going to hurt you. But he's made some assumptions about black women. And he's made some assumptions about white power. And he's made all kinds of assumptions. And she keeps saying, no, no. There's the key that it's rape, right? But in her mind, she says, he's a white man. He's a white man. And how much no can I say and how much power do I have is part of it. Well, she is raped. But she can't tell her, she doesn't want to tell her husband because all kinds of reasons. But the biggest reason, and part of it, is their relationship. Again, it's a short story and it's not all that well developed. But they have this relationship that's healthy and strong and good. And she knows that if he finds out, what'll he do? He will go after the white man, and you just don't do that. So since she doesn't tell him, he finds out by the guy dragged her into the bedroom. He finds some signs of this activity on the bed. And he asks, what is it? It's a wet handkerchief. Where does this come from? And he knows. And because she didn't tell him, now he blames her. For this is part of it. I've been betrayed by my own kind, he says. I'm sorry. The lights come on. The first thing he does when he comes home, and this kind of sets up the whole story, is if you don't mind, I'm going to stand behind you, okay?
Yeah.
I need that light. But I better take my page with me. Holden Village, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You knew if you forgot your glasses, this was going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, this is great. This is better than outside. He comes home and tells his wife he's going to hire somebody. You mean hire a man? Sure, hire somebody. What you think? Ain't that the way the white folks do? If you're going to get anywhere, you got to do just like they do. What you been doing since I've been gone? Nothing. Cooking, cleaning, and how's Ruth? That's the baby. She's all right. Sadish. You get any letters? No, but I heard Tom, but that's her. Them white folks sure is glad the war's over. He's talking about being in town. But things was kind of bad there in town. Everywhere I looked wasn't nothing but black and white soldiers. And then them white folks beat up a black soldier yesterday. He was just in from France, but still wearing a soldier's suit. They claimed he sassed a white woman. So Silas is already aware of what can happen, like as Big Boy is, and now he's going to get and find out the whole story about Sarah and the white salesman. And here's one of the great scenes of pathos in really in all of American literature, I think, one of them. I say that about 1,400 times. what's this? He asked, picking up a short yellow pencil from a crumpled quilt. She said nothing. He started toward her. You want me to take my rawhide whip and make you talk? No, Silas, you're wrong. She already guessed there was a guy in there. He was just figuring with that pencil. He was silent a moment, his eyes searching her face, and then this. God damn your black soul to hell, don't you try lying to me. If you start laying with a white man, I'll horsewhip you till an inch of your life shows there's a God in heaven, I will. From sunup to sundown, I works my guts out to pay them white trash bastards what I owe them. And then it comes and finds they've been in my house. I can't go into their houses, and you know damn well I can't. They don't have no mercy on no black folks. We just like dirt under their feet. For 10 years, I slaved like a dog to get my farm free, giving every penny I can to them. And then it comes and finds they've been in my house. If you wants to eat at my table, you're just going to keep them white trash bastards out, you hear? That white ape could come and get that damn box. He left the box since he had this sex with her. And he'll come back tomorrow and he's going to give her a $10 discount. That white ape could come and get this damn box and I ain't going to pay him a cent. He had no business leaving it here and you had no business letting him. I'm going to tell that son of a bitch something when he comes out here in the morning. So help me God, now you get back in that house. Silas, the guy does come, and Silas waits for him, and he kills him. And the two of them came out, and he killed the salesman, but his partner got away. So we know what's coming. There will be a vigilante crew coming out there. And here's another one of those great scenes of pathos. She wants Silas to get his stuff and run with her to their aunt's house. It's Aunt Peel's. He wants her to stay alive. He's angry at her, of course. But when it refers to Aunt Peel's, that's just his aunt where they're going to run to. Silas! She cried, seeing blurred objects sailing through the air and hearing him get softly in the dust. He's throwing her stuff out of the house. Get your things and go. Silas, ain't no use you saying nothing now. But they'll kill you. There ain't nothing I can do. And there ain't nothing you can do. You done too goddamn much already. Go get your things and go. They'll kill you, Silas. He pushed her off the porch. Get your things and go to Aunt Peel's. Let's both go, Silas. I'm staying here till they come back. She grabbed his arm and he slapped her hand away. She dropped to the edge of the porch and sat looking at the ground. Go away. Go away before they come. I didn't mean no harm. Go away for what? They'll kill you. It don't make no difference. He looked out over the sun-filled fields. For 10 acres, I slaved my life out to get my farm free. His voice broke off. His lips moved as though 1,000 words were spilling silently out of his mouth. As though he did not have breath enough to give them sound. He looked to the sky and back to the dust. Now it's all gone. Gone. If I run away, I ain't got nothing. If I stay and fight, I ain't got nothing. It don't make no difference which way I go. God, God, I wish all of them white folks was dead, I tell you. I wish God would kill them all. The white folks ain't never give me a chance. They never give no black man a chance. There ain't nothing in your whole life you can keep from them. They take your land, they take your freedom, they take your woman, and then they take your life, he turned to her screaming. And then I get stabbed in the back by my own blood. When my eyes is on the white folks to keep her from killing me, my own blood trips me up. He knelt in the dust again and sobbed. After a bit, he looked to the sky, his face wet with tears. I'm gonna be hard like they is. So help me God, I'm gonna be hard. When they come for me, I'm gonna be here. And when they get out of there, here's they's gonna know I'm gone. If God lets me live, I'm gonna make him feel it. But Lord, I don't want to be this way. Can I ask your thoughts?
Utilities from Jeff on one.
He's good.
I don't want to be this way. One of the themes in Wright for sure is, especially seeing the Native Son, so what creates these responses? And all these books are written in the American literature time period of naturalism or social, economic, religious determinism. And that the whole idea that our actions are so much determined by our context, our social context, that we're not really free. Which is why Wright, I think, uses so much violence. Because the violence that's going to change, it's going to take violence to change the system. And for Wright, it's more than physical violence. I think there's a kind of spiritual violence that has to be undergone to begin to see a world in a different way. Can I see a woman up in the front of the church with her? I mean, 1975, you couldn't, right? Can we see a different way? And you know all the things that have happened in social change. For Wright, something violent must have to occur to rip away, it's one of his words in some of his other fiction, rip away a vision of life to make room for another one. Biblically, it's being born again. Something dies first. well, and for this character, I don't want to be this way.
He feels trapped.
Yeah. Well, one last story. By the way, I ride my bike and I swim in the river and I water ski and I don't just sit around and deal with this. And the thing that I've learned most in a lot of years of teaching African American literature is that what started out for me as an issue of justice, simple pedagogical, educational justice, is still there, but it's changed to what I would call issues of love. And that happens as you interact with students who encounter, you know, white or black, encounter things that, that they hadn't thought about and new visions. One of my metaphors, I explained this the other night, is how does, and this would be Richard Wright's, he would approve of this metaphor. If you don't like dandelions in your lawn, and I don't, because my neighbors don't, I kind of think dandelions are kind of pretty myself. But I do this so I don't put chemicals in the river. I live on the Mississippi River, and it flows down the street and into the river and kills all the what's already getting killed again by BP. We know there's a 5,000 square mile dead spot before BP came along, and then from farmer runoff and so on, and people who put chemicals on their lawn. So I don't do that. It's pretty noble of me, isn't it? But Richard Wright would say, no, you got to learn to love dandelions. And it's a whole different, that's radicalism. And that's the kind of radical vision that Wright looks for with his characters and with his with his readers, the stimulating readers to that kind of action. The lawyer in Native Son, who defends this kid from, he doesn't defend him, he knows he murdered somebody, but he tries to give him life instead of the electric chair, said, we cannot kill this boy so that we may live. And I think what he means, this lawyer, is that we aren't living now, as long as we are so trapped by all of these assumptions and these absolutes that this is the way the world will be. We can't possibly act as free human beings. So change your whole vision. Don't just throw this kid in the electric chair so that we might live. I'll suggest what that, or I'll show you what that might be in this last short story to read. This bright and morning star. And what happens here is based on an experience that Wright didn't experience himself but knew about. A woman, son was arrested, and she knew that they were, not arrested, caught by white guys in the vigilante crew, and she knew that they were going to torture him. So she went down to save his life, and she carried a shotgun under a bunch of clothes, and they just thought she was delivering her laundry. And when she got down close, she threw the clothes off and shot a couple of them. Well, Wright has fictionalized that story, and her son is, in this story, Aunt Sue. Her son is a member of the Communist Party, and of course the status quo doesn't want anybody in the Communist Party. They're out to hunt them all down. And somehow these white guys, or one white guy, got a list of all the black communist people. And she knows that they're going to kill them or torture them or something. They've caught her son, and they're going to make him tell, this white guy's not there yet. The white guy who just got the list isn't at the, they've already got Johnny Boy, her son, and they're going to beat him until he tells them. In the meantime, the white guy's coming with all the information that they want. He got the information from Johnny Boy's mother, from Aunt Sue, by mistake. She trusted him. She thought he was part of the party. She gave him the list, and now she realizes she's been betrayed and that he's going to betray everybody. She has to stop this. So she goes down with her gun under under her sheets as well, and she knows she's only going to get off one shot. And she watches them put her son over a log and break his legs the wrong way, one at a time. And then they come up, and he's practically unconscious, and then they come up and put a hand over one ear and pop it and make him so he can't hear. And she watches all this. One of her options probably was to kill her son and save him from this torture, because they're going to kill him anyway. Her other option is to kill the guy that's torturing him. And there are several guys around her, so she might kill one, but then she's going to get it. She doesn't. She waits till the betrayer arrives and kills him.
Before
he can give the list out, right? So she lets her son suffer and die. He's going to die anyway. And she knows that she's going to die. But she's going to save this, whether or not one believes in communism. That don't even think that's Wright's point. It's that here comes a chance for a new vision to come out. This guy's going to be making sure we stick to the status quo, and that's the guy I'm going to stop. But here's how Wright puts that in some somewhat lyrical language. She was a devout Christian, still is in the end of the book, but believed that her only real life will come in the afterlife. And so the title of the story is Bright and Morning Star. He's the lily of the valley, he's the bright and morning star. She sings that song a lot, and that's her vision. Her first hope is, and she sings it, he's the lily of the valley, the bright and morning star. The days when she had sung that song were the days when she had not hoped for anything. on this earth. The days when the cold mountain had driven her into the arms of Jesus. And one of his images is that there is for all people, for all black people, this big white mountain. And people are trying to climb up it. And only little pieces fall down, but it's a white mountain. And it really is insurmountable unless there's some other way, some other kind of vision to make this mountain be something else. But enough. She had thought that, she has two sons, Sug and Johnny Boy. She had thought that Sug and Johnny Boy had taught her to forget God, to fix her hope upon the fight of black men for freedom. Through the gradual years, she had believed and worked with them, had felt strength from God still, shed from the grace of their terrible vision. That grace had been upon her when she had let the sheriff slap her down. It had been upon her when she had risen time and again from the floor and faced him. But she had trapped herself with her own hunger. To water the long, dry thirst of her faith, her pride had made a bargain which her flesh could not keep. Her having told the names of Johnny Boy's comrades was but an incident in a deeper horror. She stood up and looked at the floor, while call and counter-call, loyalty and counter-loyalty struggled in her soul. Mired she was between two abandoned worlds, living but dying without the strength of the grace that either gave. The clearer she felt it, the fuller did something well up from the depths of her for release. The more urgent did she feel the need to fling into her black sky another star, another hope, one more terrible vision to give her the strength to live and act. Softly and restlessly, she walked about the kitchen, feeling herself naked. I'm suggesting that's the kind of spiritual violence that she has to go through in order to do what she does at the end, and that is act to begin to stop the people who just want to preserve the status quo. So, what do you want to talk about? Characters, actions, your own experiences with literature or African Americans? I grew up near an Indian reservation, and those kids came to our school. Notice our school. And never played basketball. Every one of them was better than I was. Every one of them. They never went off of basketball. They never worked on the yearbook. They never. I think that's what led me to black literature. I got that.
Well, what's your reaction on your from your students when you teach black literature?
Well, what's your student population? Is it mostly?
No, it's mostly white in the school and in the class, but black students take it. I don't know how to answer that. Here's an illustration. That's the only way I can answer on the story. I've been at Rocksteady a long time, and the students know who I am. About 10 years ago, Moji's 20 years ago now, a young woman who transferred to Rocksteady didn't know who I was at all, but saw African American literature and signed up for it. Her head was shaved. She was just a gorgeous human being. Her head was shaved. She had, as an African might shave her head. Big angling earrings, a mau-mau blouse, just striking appearance. Walked into class the first day, and probably 10 other black kids were in there too, all of whom knew me. And I started telling them what, some of you missed it, and I'm not going to repeat it, but the genesis of African American literature at Augustana, which was how I confronted a book, and then I met, I guess I can tell you this part. I told them, I'd come back from the University of Oregon, changed, and I met with a bunch of black kids and said, let's do black literature at night. And we met for 17 weeks every Tuesday night for 4 hours, from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock every night. No credit for them. We read about 6 novels, about 8 plays. I mean, they did a lot of work. We just did black literature, and then went back to the administration and said, let's get this in the curriculum. And by the way, those kids got credit retroactively. They should have. But I tell students that's the genesis of the course, because I didn't just start with somebody kind of coming down trying to appease a bunch of black kids. We started from the grassroots And students knew that. Anyway, I was explaining that story I just told you, to the class, as I always do, and she just put her hand up and said, "Who the hell do you think you are? You're some white guy who read a couple of books and come in here and just teach the stuff? It's impossible. You can't do it." She started to walk out. And some black kid said, "Well, hold it." But I said, let's just give us, at that time around quarters now, give us 11 weeks together and see what happens. I met her dad at the end of the term. But you know, there's another kind of a expectation out of black people that I understand. She loved the course, and even after a week, and one, I am sincere, two, I have done my homework, I've studied it, I wrote a dissertation in it, and that matters, it's not just kind of a hobby, but I mentioned that to explain her father's reaction. I wrote a dissertation in African American literature. It's one I've been teaching it for a long time. I know the stuff. She's telling her dad at home about this course, and he said, "Who teaches it?" She said, "The track coach." He said, "That figures." Do you get that?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh.
And then she said, no, he's...
Oh, gosh.
But that's the expectation that's out there, and it's better. My first year at Holden was 1987, and I came up here because we had the theme that year was Rainbow on the Mountaintop, and they were looking for... Interesting, they got a white guy to do it. To have somebody come for 3 weeks, that was the term then, to teach African American literature, and I did. And my first day here, I just went to the anthologies. And we all know, I'm not faulting Holden, this place is dear to us all. You know how we get books? You know, people just give their old college books and stuff like that. I looked at every single anthology of American literature that Holden Village had. Not a one of them had a writer, had a poem or a short story or an essay by a black writer. I understand that. That's what I grew up with. And so I said my first year, or my last year of grad school from my master's degree level, "Who's Richard Wright?" No wonder. I didn't know. We don't know. Yeah. It's better now, though, folks. It's a lot better. High school kids know. But your stories. Yeah, Sophie.
My first trip on the other side of Mason-Dixon line was to go see my mother's girlhood friend, whose husband was being sent over to occupy Japan. He was a midshipman in the Navy. And he was scheduled somewhere near Williamsburg, because we got to see the historic town. But en route to it, we had to change in Norfolk and get on another bus. Well, in those days, the buses were crowded, and you sometimes did not get a seat. And for some reason, we were at the back, and we wound up standing. And Mother said, "Well, this is not going to be that bad." We stood on the subway. I lived in New York City for 15 minutes, and that's all we have to stand for. And the bus had taken off, and all of a sudden, the bus screeches to a halt. And the bus driver comes back and says, "Nigger, get the hell out of that seat right now. You got a white woman and a kid standing here." My mother turns around and says, "It's only 15 minutes, and this man fought for our country." He was in uniform. And he said, "Lady, I'm going to take you off the bus. You're on the other side of the Mason-Dixon line." And the black man stood up and he said, "Ma'am, I forgot my manners. I should have given a seat to a lady and a little child."
And Silas gets that, these characters, the indignities suffered. Yeah. Thank you. That's a great story. It's supper time, but I will talk about black literature forever, so you don't want to stop. You haven't eaten yet, have you? Right.
Well, there's no escaping this. I mean, it's original sin. There's always a status quo being defended by someone. It's based upon self-interest and power.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is violence, spiritually or physically, that a company is changing or questioning or offering a new vision on that, what are some of the other choices? And it, does it always end up, in case of Jesus, with death? Gandhi, King, Peter, Paul. I mean, that's whether it's a spiritual death or a literal death. And is it worth it? If every generation is going to experience the same stuff. That's a hard question. That this
and
makes me think about.
Everybody answers it differently. The guys who fight for it. I mean, Silas thought it was worth it. I'm going to stay here and fight. It's interesting. That's a great question. And the answer, the question is the question. In this story, Big Boy leaves home, the first one, gets on a truck and flees. In the second to the last story, Silas stays in his house and fights. And each story up through the five, they progressively, the main character, completely different stories, different characters, everything. But the main characters, they don't flee at the end. And in fact, at the very end, the last one, Aunt Sue comes to them and says, I'm going to fight for this. Mm-hmm. So they didn't think it was worth it, in Big Boy, they didn't think it was worth it to keep their son at home. They let him fight. I mean, he knows he can't go to court. He can't get a lawyer, I guess. And Sue thought it was worth it, knowing she was going to die, to save that. So that, I'm giving you Richard Wright's answer, perhaps. I suppose it depends. That's a great question.
But the foretaste of the feast to come next week. We're talking about Holy Week. And what discipleship means in the context of dying.
Peter's the Bible study teacher next week. And remember, Fred had the great line today, God would rather die, remember that one? Remember that?
Yeah.
Than what? Than count sins?
He quoted Tom on that.
Huh?
He quoted
Tom on that, yeah, that's right. Well, thank you for your interest. And